Silent Spring, Disc 8.
The road to cancer may also be an indirect one. A substance that is not a carcinogen in the ordinary sense may disturb the normal functioning of some part of the body in such a way that malignancy results. Important examples are the cancers, especially of the reproductive system, that appear to be linked with disturbances of the balance of sex hormones. These disturbances, in turn, may in some cases be the result of something that affects the ability of the liver to preserve a proper level of these hormones. The chlorinated hydrocarbons are precisely the kind of agent that can bring about this kind of indirect carcinogenesis, because all of them are toxic in some degree to the liver. The sex hormones are, of course, normally present in the body and perform a necessary growth-stimulating function in relation to the various organs of reproduction. But the body has a built-in protection against excessive accumulations, for the liver acts to keep a proper balance between male and female hormones. Both are produced in the bodies of both sexes, although in different amounts, and to prevent an excess accumulation of either. It cannot do so, however, if it has been damaged by disease or chemicals, or if the supply of the B-complex vitamins has been reduced. Under these conditions, the estrogens build up to abnormally high levels. What are the effects? In animals, at least, there is abundant evidence from experiments. In one such, an investigator at the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research found that rabbits with livers damaged by disease show a very high incidence of uterine tumors, thought to have developed because the liver was no longer able to inactivate the estrogens in the blood, so that they subsequently rose to a carcinogenic level. Extensive experiments on mice, rats, guinea pigs, and monkeys show that prolonged administration of estrogens, not necessarily at high levels, has caused changes in the tissues of the reproductive organs, varying from benign overgrowths to definite malignancy. Tumors of the kidneys have been induced in hamsters by administering estrogens. Although medical opinion is divided on the question, much evidence exists to support the view that similar effects may occur in human tissues. Investigators at the Royal Victoria Hospital at McGill University found 2/3 of 150 cases of uterine cancer studied by them gave evidence of abnormally high estrogen levels. In 90% of a later series of 20 cases, there was a similar high estrogen activity. It is possible to have liver damage sufficient to interfere with estrogen elimination without detection of the damage by any tests now available to the medical profession. This can easily be caused by the chlorinated hydrocarbons, which, as we have seen, set up changes in liver cells at very low levels of intake. They also cause loss of the B vitamins. This, too, is extremely important, for other chains of evidence show the protective role of these vitamins against cancer. The late C.P. Rhodes, one-time director of the Sloan Kettering Institute for Cancer Research, found that test animals exposed to a very potent chemical carcinogen developed no cancer if they had been fed yeast, a rich source of natural B vitamins. A deficiency of these vitamins has been found to accompany mouth cancer and perhaps cancer of other sites in the digestive tract. This has been observed not only in the United States, but in the far northern parts of Sweden and Finland, where the diet is ordinarily deficient in vitamins. Groups prone to primary liver cancer, as for example the Bantu tribes of Africa, are typically subject to malnutrition. Cancer of the male breast is also prevalent in parts of Africa, associated with liver disease and malnutrition. In post-war Greece, enlargement of the male breast was a common accompaniment of periods of starvation. In brief, the argument for the indirect role of pesticides in cancer is based on their proven ability to damage the liver and to reduce the supply of B vitamins, thus leading to an increase in the endogenous estrogens, or those produced by the body itself. Added to these are the wide variety of synthetic estrogens to which we are increasingly exposed, those in cosmetics, drugs, foods, and occupational exposures. The combined effect is a matter that warrants the most serious concern. Human exposures to cancer-producing chemicals, including pesticides, are uncontrolled and they are multiple. An individual may have many different exposures to the same chemical. Arsenic is an example. It exists in the environment of every individual in many different guises, as an air pollutant, a contaminant of water, a pesticide residue on food, in medicines, cosmetics, wood preservatives, or as a coloring agent in paints and inks. It is quite possible that no one of these exposures alone would be sufficient to precipitate malignancy. Yet any single, supposedly safe dose may be enough to tip the scales that are already loaded with other safe doses. Or again, the harm may be done by two or more different carcinogens acting together, so that there is a summation of their effects. The individual exposed to DDT, for example, is almost certain to be exposed to other liver-damaging hydrocarbons, which are so widely used as solvents, paint removers, degreasing agents, dry-cleaning fluids, and anesthetics. What, then, can be a safe dose of DDT? The situation is made even more complicated by the fact that one chemical may act on another to alter its effect. Cancer may sometimes require the complementary action of two chemicals, one of which sensitizes the cell or tissue so that it may later, under the action of another or promoting agent, develop true malignancy. Thus, the herbicides IPC and CIPC may act as initiators in the production of skin tumors, sowing the seeds of malignancy that may be brought into actual being by something else. Perhaps a common detergent. There may be interaction, too, between a physical and a chemical agent. Leukemia may occur as a two-step process, the malignant change being initiated by X radiation, the promoting action being supplied by a chemical, as, for example, urethane. The growing exposure of the population to radiation from various sources, plus the many contacts with a host of chemicals, suggest a grave new problem for the modern world. The pollution of water supplies with radioactive materials poses another problem. Such materials present as contaminants in water that also contains chemicals may actually change the nature of the chemicals by the impact of ionizing radiation, rearranging their atoms in unpredictable ways to create new chemicals. Water pollution experts throughout the United States are concerned by the fact that detergents are now a troublesome and practically universal contaminant of public water supplies. There is no practical way to remove them by treatment. Few detergents are known to be carcinogenic, but in an indirect way, they may promote cancer by acting on the lining of the digestive tract, changing the tissues so that they more easily absorb dangerous chemicals, thereby aggravating their effect. But who can foresee and control this action? In the kaleidoscope of shifting conditions, what dose of a carcinogen can be safe, except a zero dose? We tolerate cancer-causing agents in our environment at our peril, as was clearly illustrated in a recent happening. In the spring of 1961, an epidemic of liver cancer appeared among rainbow trout in many federal, state, and private hatcheries. Trout in both eastern and western parts of the United States were affected. In some areas, practically 100% of the trout over 3 years of age developed cancer. This discovery was made because of a pre-existing arrangement between the Environmental Cancer Section of the National Cancer Institute and the Fish and Wildlife Service for the reporting of all fish with tumors so that early warning might be had of a cancer hazard to man from water contaminants. Although studies are still underway to determine the exact cause of this epidemic over so wide an area, The best evidence is said to point to some agent present in the prepared hatchery feeds. These contain an incredible variety of chemical additives and medicinal agents in addition to the basic foodstuffs. The story of the trout is important for many reasons, but chiefly as an example of what can happen when a potent carcinogen is introduced into the environment of any species. Dr. Huper has described this epidemic as a serious warning that greatly increased attention must be given to controlling the number and variety of environmental carcinogens. If such preventive measures are not taken, says Dr. Huper, the stage will be set at a progressive rate for the future occurrence of a similar disaster to the human population. The discovery that we are, as one investigator phrased it, living in a sea of carcinogens, is of course dismaying and may easily lead to reactions of despair and defeatism. Isn't it a hopeless situation, is the common reaction? Isn't it impossible to even attempt to eliminate these cancer-producing agents from our world? Wouldn't it be better not to waste time trying, but instead to put all our efforts into research to find a cure for cancer? When this question is put to Dr. Huper, whose years of distinguished work in cancer make his opinion one to respect, his reply is given with the thoughtfulness of one who has pondered it long and has a lifetime of research and experience behind his judgment. Dr. Huper believes that our situation with regard to cancer today is very similar to that which faced mankind with regard to infectious diseases in the closing years of the 19th century. The causative relation between pathogenic organisms and many diseases had been established through the brilliant work of Pasteur and Koch. Medical men and even the general public were becoming aware that the human environment was inhabited by an enormous number of microorganisms capable of causing disease, just as today carcinogens pervade our surroundings. Most infectious diseases have now been brought under a reasonable degree of control, and some have been practically eliminated. This brilliant medical achievement came about by an attack that was twofold, that stressed prevention as well as cure. Despite the prominence that magic bullets and wonder drugs hold in the layman's mind, most of the really decisive battles in the war against infectious diseases consisted of measures to eliminate disease organisms from the environment. An example from history concerns the great outbreak of cholera in London more than 100 years ago. A London physician, John Snow, mapped the occurrence of cases and found they originated in one area, all of whose inhabitants drew their water from one pump located on Broad Street. In a swift and decisive practice of preventive medicine, Dr. Snow removed the handle from the pump. The epidemic was thereby brought under control, not by a magic pill that killed the then unknown organism of cholera, but by eliminating the organism from the environment. Even therapeutic measures have the important result not only of curing the patient, but of reducing the foci of infection. The present comparative rarity of tuberculosis results in large measure from the fact that the average person now seldom comes in contact with tubercle bacillus. Today, we find our world filled with cancer-producing agents. An attack on cancer that is concentrated wholly or even largely on therapeutic measures, even assuming a cure could be found, in Dr. Huper's opinion, will fail, because it leaves untouched the great reservoirs of carcinogenic agents, which would continue to claim new victims faster than the as yet elusive cure could allay the disease. Why have we been slow to adopt this common-sense approach to the cancer problem? Probably the goal of curing the victims of cancer is more exciting, more tangible, more glamorous and rewarding than prevention, says Dr. Huper. Yet to prevent cancer from ever being formed is definitely more humane and can be much more effective than cancer cures. Dr. Huper has little patience with the wishful thinking that promises a magic pill that we shall take each morning before breakfast as protection against cancer. Part of the public trust in such an eventual outcome results from the misconception that cancer is a single, though mysterious, disease with a single cause and hopefully a single cure. This, of course, is far from the known truth. Just as environmental cancers are induced by a wide variety of chemical and physical agents, so the malignant condition itself is manifested in many different and biologically distinct ways. The long-promised breakthrough, when or if it comes, cannot be expected to be the panacea for all types of malignancy. Although the search must be continued for therapeutic measures to relieve and to cure those who have already become victims of cancer, it is a disservice to humanity to hold out the hope that the solution will come suddenly in a single master stroke. It will come slowly, one step at a time. Meanwhile, as we pour our millions into research and invest all our hopes in vast programs to find cures for established cases of cancer, we are neglecting the golden opportunity to prevent, even while we seek to cure. The task is by no means a hopeless one. In one important respect, the outlook is more encouraging than the situation regarding infectious diseases at the turn of the century. The world was then full of disease germs, as today it is full of carcinogens. But man did not put the germs into the environment, and his role in spreading them was involuntary. In contrast, man has put the vast majority of carcinogens into the environment, and he can, if he wishes, eliminate many of them. The chemical agents of cancer have become entrenched in our world in two ways. First, and ironically, through man's search for a better and easier way of life. Second, because the manufacture and sale of such chemicals has become an accepted part of our economy and our way of life. It would be unrealistic to suppose that all chemical carcinogens can or will be eliminated from the modern world. But a very large proportion are by no means necessities of life. By their elimination, the total load of carcinogens would be enormously lightened, and the threat that one in every four will develop cancer would at least be greatly mitigated. The most determined effort should be made to eliminate those carcinogens that now contaminate our food, our water supplies, and our atmosphere, because these provide the most dangerous type of contact. Minute exposures repeated over and over throughout the years. Among the most eminent men in cancer research are many others who share Dr. Huper's belief that malignant diseases can be reduced significantly by determined efforts to identify the environmental causes and to eliminate them or reduce their impact. For those in whom cancer is already a hidden or visible presence, efforts to find cures must, of course, continue. But for those not yet touched by the disease, and certainly for the generations as yet unborn, prevention is the imperative need. Chapter 15, Nature Fights Back. To have risked so much in our efforts to mold nature to our satisfaction, and yet to have failed in achieving our goal, would indeed be the final irony. Yet this, it seems, is our situation. The truth, seldom mentioned, but there for anyone to see, is that nature is not so easily molded, and that the insects are finding ways to circumvent our chemical attacks on them. "The insect world is nature's most astonishing phenomenon," said the Dutch biologist C.J. Breer. "Nothing is impossible to it. The most improbable things commonly occur there. One who penetrates deeply into the mysteries is continually breathless with wonder. He knows that anything can happen, and that the completely impossible often does." The impossible is now happening on two broad fronts. By a process of genetic selection, the insects are developing strains resistant to chemicals. This will be discussed in the following chapter. But the broader problem, which we shall look at now, is the fact that our chemical attack is weakening the defenses inherent in the environment itself, defenses designed to keep the various species in check. Each time we breach these defenses, a horde of insects pours through. From all over the world come reports that make it clear we are in a serious predicament. At the end of a decade or more of intensive chemical control, entomologists were finding that problems that they had considered solved a few years earlier had returned to plague them. And new problems had arisen, as insects, once present only in insignificant numbers, had increased to the status of serious pests. By their very nature, chemical controls are self-defeating, for they have been devised and applied without taking into account the complex biological systems against which they have been blindly hurled. The chemicals may have been pre-tested against a few individual species, but not against living communities. In some quarters nowadays, it is fashionable to dismiss the balance of nature as a state of affairs that prevailed in an earlier, simpler world, a state that has now been so thoroughly upset that we might as well forget it. Some find this a convenient assumption, but as a chart for a course of action, it is highly dangerous. The balance of nature is not the same today as in Pleistocene times, but it is still there, a complex, precise, and highly integrated system of relationships between living things which cannot safely be ignored, any more than the law of gravity can be defied with impunity by a man perched on the edge of a cliff. The balance of nature is not a status quo. It is fluid, ever-shifting, in a constant state of adjustment. Man, too, is part of this balance. Sometimes the balance is in his favor. Sometimes, and all too often through his own activities, it is shifted to his disadvantage. Two critically important facts have been overlooked in designing the modern insect control programs. The first is that the really effective control of insects is that applied by nature, not by man. Populations are kept in check by something the ecologists call the resistance of the environment, and this has been so since the first life was created. The amount of food available, conditions of weather and climate, the presence of competing or predatory species, all are critically important. The greatest single factor in preventing insects from overwhelming the rest of the world is the internecine warfare that they carry out among themselves, said the entomologist Robert Metcalf. Yet most of the chemicals now used kill all insects, our friends and enemies alike. The second neglected fact is the truly explosive power of a species to reproduce once the resistance of the environment has been weakened. The fecundity of many forms of life is almost beyond our power to imagine, though now and then we have suggestive glimpses. I remember from student days the miracle that could be wrought in a jar containing a simple mixture of hay and water, merely by adding to it a few drops of material from a mature culture of protozoa. Within a few days, the jar would contain a whole galaxy of whirling, darting life, unaccountable trillions of the slipper animalcule paramecium, each small as a dust grain, all multiplying without restraint in their temporary Eden of favorable temperatures, abundant food, absence of enemies. Or I think of shore rocks white with barnacles as far as the eye can see, or of the spectacle of passing through an immense school of jellyfish, mile after mile, with seemingly no end to the pulsing, ghostly forms scarcely more substantial than the water itself. We see the miracle of nature's control at work when the cod move through the winter seas to their spawning grounds, where each female deposits several millions of eggs. The sea does not become a solid mass of cod as it would surely do if all the progeny of all the cod were to survive. The checks that exist in nature are such that out of the millions of young produced by each pair, only enough on the average survive to adulthood to replace the parent fish. Biologists used to entertain themselves by speculating as to what would happen if, through some unthinkable catastrophe, the natural restraints were thrown off and all progeny of a single individual survived. Thus, Thomas Huxley a century ago calculated that a single female aphis, which has the curious power of reproducing without mating, could produce progeny in a single year's time whose total weight would equal that of the inhabitants of the Chinese Empire of his day. Fortunately for us, such an extreme situation is only theoretical, but the dire results of upsetting nature's own arrangements are well known to students of animal populations. The stockman's zeal for eliminating the coyote has resulted in plagues of field mice, which the coyote formerly controlled. The oft-repeated story of the kaibab deer in Arizona is another case in point. At one time, the deer population was in equilibrium with its environment. A number of predators, wolves, pumas, and coyotes, prevented the deer from outrunning their food supply. Then a campaign was begun to conserve the deer by killing off their enemies. Once the predators were gone, the deer increased prodigiously, and soon there was not enough food for them. The browse line on the trees went higher and higher as they sought food, and in time many more deer were dying of starvation than had formerly been killed by predators. The whole environment, moreover, was damaged by their desperate efforts to find food. The predatory insects of field and forests play the same role as the wolves and coyotes of the kaibab. Kill them off, and the population of the prey insect surges upward. No one knows how many species of insects inhabit the earth, because so many are yet to be identified. But more than 700,000 have already been described. This means that in terms of the number of species, 70% to 80% of the earth's creatures are insects. The vast majority of these insects are held in check by natural forces without any intervention by man. If this were not so, it is doubtful that any conceivable volume of chemicals or any other methods could possibly keep down their populations. The trouble is that we are seldom aware of the protection afforded by natural enemies until it fails. Most of us walk unseeing through the world, unaware alike of its beauties, its wonders, and the strange and sometimes terrible intensity of the lives that are being lived about us. So it is that activities of the insect predators and parasites are known to few. Perhaps we may have noticed an oddly shaped insect of ferocious mien on a bush in the garden, and been dimly aware that the praying mantis lives at the expense of other insects. But we see with understanding eye only if we have walked in the garden at night and here and there with a flashlight have glimpsed the mantis stealthily creeping upon her prey. Then we sense something of the drama of the hunter and the hunted. Then we begin to feel something of that relentlessly pressing force by which nature controls her own. The predators, insects that kill and consume other insects, are of many kinds. Some are quick and with the speed of swallows snatch their prey from the air. Others plod methodically along a stem, plucking off and devouring sedentary insects like the aphids. The yellow jackets capture soft-bodied insects and feed the juices to their young. Mud dauber wasps build column nests of mud under the eaves of houses and stock them with insects on which their young will feed. The horse guard wasp hovers above herds of grazing cattle, destroying the blood-sucking flies that torment them. The loudly buzzing syrphid fly, often mistaken for a bee, lays its eggs on leaves of aphis-infested plants. The hatching larvae then consume immense numbers of aphids. Ladybugs or lady beetles are among the most effective destroyers of aphids, scale insects, and other plant-eating insects. Literally hundreds of aphids are consumed by a single ladybug to stoke the little fires of energy which she requires to produce even a single batch of eggs. Even more extraordinary in their habits are the parasitic insects. These do not kill their hosts outright. Instead, by a variety of adaptations, they utilize their victims for the nurture of their own young. They may deposit their eggs within the larvae or eggs of their prey so that their own developing young may find food by consuming the host. Some attach their eggs to a caterpillar by means of a sticky solution. On hatching, the larval parasite bores through the skin of the host. Others, led by an instinct that simulates foresight, merely lay their eggs on a leaf so that a browsing caterpillar will eat them inadvertently. Everywhere, in field and hedgerow and garden and forest, the insect predators and parasites are at work. Here, above a pond, the dragonflies dart and the sun strikes fire from their wings. So their ancestors sped through the swamps where huge reptiles lived. Now, as in those ancient times, the sharp-eyed dragonflies capture mosquitoes in the air, scooping them in with basket-shaped legs. In the waters below, their young, the dragonfly nymphs, or naiads, prey on the aquatic stages of mosquitoes and other insects. Or there, almost invisible against a leaf, is the lacewing, with green gauze wings and golden eyes, shy and secretive, descendant of an ancient race that lived in Permian times. The adult lacewing feeds mostly on plant nectars and the honeydew of aphids, and in time she lays her eggs, each on the end of a long stalk which she fastens to a leaf. From these emerge her children, strange, bristled larvae called aphis lions, which live by preying on aphids, scales, or mites, which they capture and suck dry of fluid. Each may consume several hundred aphids before the ceaseless turning of the cycle of its life brings the time when it will spin a white silken cocoon in which to pass the pupal stage. And there are many wasps and flies as well, whose very existence depends on the destruction of the eggs or larvae of other insects through parasitism. Some of the egg parasites are exceedingly minute wasps, yet by their numbers and their great activity, they hold down the abundance of many crop-destroying species. All these small creatures are working. Working in sun and rain, during the hours of darkness, even when winter's grip has damped down the fires of life to mere embers. Then this vital force is merely smoldering, awaiting the time to flare again into activity when spring awakens the insect world. Meanwhile, under the white blanket of snow, below the frost-hardened soil, in crevices in the bark of trees, and in sheltered caves, the parasites and the predators have found ways to tide themselves over the season of cold. The eggs of the mantis are secure in little cases of thin parchment attached to the branch of a shrub by the mother who lived her lifespan with the summer that is gone. The female Polistes wasp, taking shelter in a forgotten corner of some attic, carries in her body the fertilized eggs, the heritage on which the whole future of her colony depends. She, the lone survivor, will start a small paper nest in the spring, lay a few eggs in its cells, and carefully rear a small force of workers. With their help, she will then enlarge the nest and develop the colony. Then the workers, foraging ceaselessly through the hot days of summer, will destroy countless caterpillars. Thus, through the circumstances of their lives and the nature of our own wants, all these have been our allies in keeping the balance of nature tilted in our favor. Yet we have turned our artillery against our friends. The terrible danger is that we've grossly underestimated their value in keeping at bay a dark tide of enemies that without their help can overrun us. The prospect of a general and permanent lowering of environmental resistance becomes grimly and increasingly real with each passing year as the number, variety, and destructiveness of insecticides grows. with the passage of time, we may expect progressively more serious outbreaks of insects, both disease-carrying and crop-destroying species, in excess of anything we have ever known. Yes, but isn't this all theoretical, you may ask? Surely it won't really happen, not in my lifetime anyway. But it is happening, here and now. Scientific journals had already recorded some 50 species involved in violent dislocations of nature's balance by 1958. More examples are being found every year. A recent review of the subject contained references to 215 papers reporting or discussing unfavorable upsets in the balance of insect populations caused by pesticides. Sometimes the result of chemical spraying has been a tremendous upsurge of the very insect the spraying was intended to control, as when black flies in Ontario became 17 times more abundant after spraying than they had been before. Or when in England an enormous outbreak of the cabbage aphid, an outbreak that had no parallel on record, followed spraying with one of the organic phosphorus chemicals. At other times, spraying, while reasonably effective against the target insect, has let loose a whole Pandora's box of destructive pests that had never previously been abundant enough to cause trouble. The spider mite, for example, has become practically a worldwide pest as DDT and other insecticides have killed off its enemies. The spider mite is not an insect. It is a barely visible eight-legged creature belonging to the group that includes spiders, scorpions, and ticks. It has mouth parts adapted for piercing and sucking, and a prodigious appetite for the chlorophyll that makes the world green. It inserts these minute and stiletto-sharp mouth parts into the outer cells of leaves and evergreen needles and extracts the chlorophyll. A mild infestation gives trees and shrubbery a mottled or salt and pepper appearance. With a heavy mite population, foliage turns yellow and falls. This is what happened in some of the Western National Forests a few years ago, when in 1956 the United States Forest Service sprayed some 885,000 acres of forested lands with DDT. The intention was to control the spruce budworm, but the following summer it was discovered that a problem worse than the budworm damage had been created. In surveying the forests from the air, vast, blighted areas could be seen where the magnificent Douglas firs were turning brown and dropping their needles. In the Helena National Forest, and on the western slopes of the Big Belt Mountains, then in other areas of Montana and down into Idaho, the forest looked as though they had been scorched. It was evident that this summer of 1957 had brought the most extensive and spectacular infestation of spider mites in history. Almost all of the sprayed area was affected. Nowhere else was the damage evident. Searching for precedents, the foresters could remember other scourges of spider mites, though less dramatic than this one. There had been similar trouble along the Madison River in Yellowstone Park in 1929, in Colorado 20 years later, and then in New Mexico in 1956. Each of these outbreaks had followed forest spraying with insecticides. The 1929 spraying, occurring before the DDT era, employed lead arsenate. Why does a spider mite appear to thrive on insecticides? Besides the obvious fact that it is relatively insensitive to them, there seem to be two other reasons. In nature, it is kept in check by various predators such as ladybugs, a gall midge, predaceous mites, and several pirate bugs, all of them extremely sensitive to insecticides. The third reason has to do with population pressure within the spider mite colonies. An undisturbed colony of mites is a densely settled community, huddled under protective webbing for concealment from its enemies. When sprayed, the colonies disperse, as the mites, irritated, though not killed by the chemicals, scatter out in search of places where they will not be disturbed. In so doing, they find a far greater abundance of space and food than was available in the former colonies. Their enemies are now dead, so there is no need for the mites to spend their energy in secreting protective webbing. Instead, they pour all their energies into producing more mites. It is not uncommon for their egg production to be increased threefold, all through the beneficent effect of insecticides. In the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, a famous apple-growing region, hordes of a small insect called the red-banded leaf roller arose to plague the growers as soon as DDT began to replace arsenate of lead. Its depredations had never before been important. Soon its toll rose to 50% of the crop, and it achieved the status of the most destructive pest of apples, not only in this region, but throughout much of the East and Midwest, as the use of DDT increased. The situation abounds in ironies. In the apple orchards of Nova Scotia in the late 1940s, the worst infestations of the coddling moth, cause of wormy apples, were in the orchards regularly sprayed. In unsprayed orchards, the moths were not abundant enough to cause real trouble. Diligence in spraying had a similarly unsatisfactory reward in the eastern Sudan, where cotton growers had a bitter experience with DDT. Some 60,000 acres of cotton were being grown under irrigation in the Gash Delta. Early trials of DDT having given apparently good results, spraying was intensified. It was then that trouble began. One of the most destructive enemies of cotton is the bollworm, but the more cotton was sprayed, the more bollworms appeared. The unsprayed cotton suffered less damage to fruits and later to mature bolls than the sprayed, and in twice-sprayed fields, the yield of seed cotton dropped significantly. Although some of the leaf-feeding insects were eliminated, any benefit that might thus have been gained was more than offset by bollworm damage. In the end, the growers were faced with the unpleasant truth that their cotton yield would have been greater had they saved themselves the trouble and the expense of spraying. In the Belgian Congo and Uganda, the results of heavy applications of DDT against an insect pest of the coffee bush were almost catastrophic. The pest itself was found to be almost completely unaffected by the DDT, while its predator was extremely sensitive. In America, farmers have repeatedly traded one insect enemy for a worse one, as spraying upsets the population dynamics of the insect world. Two of the mass spraying programs recently carried out have had precisely this effect. One was the fire ant eradication program in the South, the other was the spraying for the Japanese beetle in the Midwest, previously mentioned in chapters 10 and 7. When a wholesale application of heptachlor was made to the farmlands in Louisiana in 1957, the result was the unleashing of one of the worst enemies of the sugarcane crop, the sugarcane borer. Soon after the heptachlor treatment, damage by borers increased sharply. The chemical aimed at the fire ant had killed off the enemies of the borer. The crop was so severely damaged that farmers sought to bring suit against the state for negligence in not warning them that this might happen. The same bitter lesson was learned by Illinois farmers. After the devastating bath of dieldrin recently administered to the farmlands in eastern Illinois for the control of the Japanese beetle, farmers discovered that corn borers had increased enormously in the treated area. In fact, corn grown in fields within this area contained almost twice as many of the destructive larvae of this insect as did the corn grown outside. The farmers may not yet be aware of the biological basis of what has happened, but they need no scientist to tell them they have made a poor bargain. In trying to get rid of one insect, they have brought on a scourge of a much more destructive one. According to the Department of Agriculture estimates, total damage by the Japanese beetle in the United States adds up to about $10 million a year, while damage by the corn borer runs to about $85 million. It is worth noting that natural forces had been heavily relied on for control of the corn borer. Within 2 years after this insect was accidentally introduced from Europe in 1917, the United States government had mounted one of its most intensive programs for locating and importing parasites of an insect pest. Since that time, 24 species of parasites of the corn borer had been brought in from Europe and the Orient at considerable expense. Of these, 5 are recognized as being of distinct value and control. Needless to say, the results of all this work are now jeopardized, as the enemies of the corn borer are killed off by the sprays. If this seems absurd, consider the situation in the citrus groves of California, where the world's most famous and successful experiment in biological control was carried out in the 1880s. In 1872, a scale insect that feeds on the sap of citrus trees appeared in California, and within the next 15 years developed into a pest so destructive that the fruit crop in many orchards was a complete loss. The young citrus industry was threatened with destruction. Many farmers gave up and pulled out their trees. Then a parasite of the scale insect was imported from Australia, a small lady beetle called the Vidalia. Within only 2 years after the first shipment of the beetles, the scale was under complete control throughout the citrus-growing sections of California. From that time on, one could search for days among the orange groves without finding a single scale insect. Then in the 1940s, the citrus growers began to experiment with glamorous new chemicals against other insects. With the advent of DDT and the even more toxic chemicals to follow, the populations of the Vidalia in many sections of California were wiped out. Its importation had cost the government a mere $5,000. Its activities had saved the fruit growers several millions of dollars a year. But in a moment of heedlessness, the benefit was canceled out. Infestations of the scale insect quickly reappeared, and damage exceeded anything that had been seen for 50 years. "This possibly marked the end of an era," said Dr. Paul DeBock of the Citrus Experiment Station in Riverside. "Now control of the scale has become enormously complicated. The Vidalia can be maintained only by repeated releases and by the most careful attention to spray schedules to minimize their contact with insecticides. And regardless of what the citrus growers do, they are more or less at the mercy of the owners of adjacent acreages, for severe damage has been done by insecticidal drift." All these examples concern insects that attack agricultural crops. What of those that carry disease? There have already been warnings. On Nisan Island in the South Pacific, for example, spraying had been carried on intensively during the Second World War, but was stopped when hostilities came to an end. Soon swarms of a malaria-carrying mosquito reinvaded the island. All of its predators had been killed off, and there had not been time for new populations to become established. The way was therefore clear for a tremendous population explosion. Marshall Laird, who had described this incident, compares chemical control to a treadmill. Once we have set foot on it, we are unable to stop for fear of the consequences. In some parts of the world, disease can be linked with spraying in quite a different way. For some reason, snail-like mollusks seem to be almost immune to the effects of insecticides. This has been observed many times. In the general holocaust that followed the spraying of salt marshes in eastern Florida, aquatic snails alone survived. The scene as described was a macabre picture, something that might have been created by a surrealist brush. The snails moved among the bodies of the dead fishes and the moribund crabs, devouring the victims of the death rain of poison. But why is this important? It is important because many aquatic snails serve as hosts of dangerous parasitic worms that spend part of their life cycle in a mollusk, part in a human being. Examples are the blood flukes, or schistosoma, that cause serious disease in man when they enter the body by way of drinking water, or through the skin when people are bathing in infested waters. The flukes are released into the water by the host snails. Such diseases are especially prevalent in parts of Asia and Africa. Where they occur, insect control measures that favor a vast increase of snails are likely to be followed by grave consequences. And of course, man is not alone in being subject to a snail-borne disease. Liver disease in cattle, sheep, goats, deer, elk, rabbits, and various other warm-blooded animals may be caused by liver flukes that spend part of their life cycles in freshwater snails. Livers infested with these worms are unfit for use as human food and are routinely condemned. Such rejections cost American cattlemen about $3.5 million annually. Anything that acts to increase the number of snails can obviously make this problem an even more serious one. Over the past decade, these problems have cast long shadows, but we have been slow to recognize them. Most of those best fitted to develop natural controls and assist in putting them into effect have been too busy laboring in the more exciting vineyards of chemical control. It was reported in 1960 that only 2% of all the economic entomologists in the country were then working in the field of biological controls. A substantial number of the remaining 98% were engaged in research on chemical insecticides. Why should this be? The major chemical companies are pouring money into the universities to support research on insecticides. This creates attractive fellowships for graduate students and attractive staff positions. Biological control studies, on the other hand, are never so endowed, for the simple reason that they do not promise anyone the fortunes that are to be made in the chemical industry. These are left to state and federal agencies, where the salaries paid are far less. This situation also explains the otherwise mystifying fact that certain outstanding entomologists are among the leading advocates of chemical control. Inquiry into the background of some of these men reveals that their entire research program is supported by the chemical industry. Their professional prestige, sometimes their very jobs, depend on the perpetuation of chemical methods. Can we then expect them to bite the hand that literally feeds them? But knowing their bias, how much credence can we give their protests that insecticides are harmless? Amid the general acclaim for chemicals as the principal method of insect control, minority reports have occasionally been filed by those few entomologists who have not lost sight of the fact that they are neither chemists nor engineers, but biologists. F.H. Jacob in England has declared that the activities of many so-called economic entomologists would make it appear that they operate in the belief that salvation lies at the end of a spray nozzle, that when they have created problems of resurgence or resistance or mammalian toxicity, the chemist will be ready with another pill. That view is not held here. Ultimately, only the biologist will provide the answers to the basic problems of pest control. Economic entomologists must realize, wrote A.D. Pickett of Nova Scotia, that they are dealing with living things. Their work must be more than simply insecticide testing or a quest for highly destructive chemicals. Dr. Pickett himself was a pioneer in the field of working out sane methods of insect control that take full advantage of the predatory and parasitic species. The method which he and his associates evolved is today a shining model, but one too little emulated. Only in the integrated control programs developed by some California entomologists do we find anything comparable in this country. Dr. Pickett began his work some 35 years ago in the apple orchards of the Annapolis Valley in Nova Scotia, once one of the most concentrated fruit-growing areas in Canada. At that time, it was believed that insecticides, then inorganic chemicals, would solve the problems of insect control, that the only task was to induce fruit growers to follow the recommended methods. But the rosy picture failed to materialize. Somehow the insects persisted. New chemicals were added, better spraying equipment was devised, and the zeal for spraying increased, but the insect problem did not get any better. Then DDT promised to obliterate the nightmare of coddling moth outbreaks. What actually resulted from its use was an unprecedented scourge of mites. We move from crisis to crisis, merely trading one problem for another, said Dr. Pickett. At this point, however, Dr. Pickett and his associates struck out on a new road instead of going along with other entomologists who continued to pursue the will-o'-the-wisp of the ever more toxic chemical. Recognizing that they had a strong ally in nature, they devised a program that makes maximum use of natural controls and minimum use of insecticides. Whenever insecticides are applied, only minimum dosages are used, barely enough to control the pest, without avoidable harm to beneficial species. Proper timing also enters in. Thus, if nicotine sulfate is applied before rather than after the apple blossoms turn pink, one of the important predators is spared, probably because it is still in the egg stage. Dr. Pickett uses special care to select chemicals that will do as little harm as possible to insect parasites and predators. When we reach the point of using DDT, parathion, chlorodane, and other new insecticides as routine control measures in the same way we have used the inorganic chemicals in the past, entomologists interested in biological control may as well throw in the sponge, he says. Instead of these highly toxic, broad-spectrum insecticides, he places chief reliance on Ryania, derived from ground stems of a tropical plant, nicotine sulfate, and lead arsenate. In certain situations, very weak concentrations of DDT or malathion are used, 1 or 2 ounces per 100 gallons, in contrast to the usual 1 or 2 pounds per 100 gallons. Although these two are the least toxic of the modern insecticides, Dr. Pickett hopes by further research to replace them with safer and more selective materials. How well has this program worked? Nova Scotia orchardists who are following Dr. Pickett's modified spray program are producing as high a proportion of first-grade fruit as are those who are using intensive chemical applications. They are also getting as good production. They are getting these results, moreover, at a substantially lower cost. The outlay for insecticides in Nova Scotia apple orchards is only from 10% to 20% of the amount spent in most other apple growing areas. More important than even these excellent results is the fact that the modified program worked out by these Nova Scotian entomologists is not doing violence to nature's balance. It is well on the way to realizing the philosophy stated by the Canadian entomologist G.C. Ulliott a decade ago. We must change our philosophy, abandon our attitude of human superiority, and admit that in many cases in natural environments we find ways and means of limiting populations of organisms in a more economical way than we can do it ourselves. Chapter 16. The Rumblings of an Avalanche. If Darwin were alive today, the insect world would delight and astound him with its impressive verification of his theories of the survival of the fittest. Under the stress of intensive chemical spraying, the weaker members of the insect populations are being weeded out. Now, in many areas and among many species, only the strong and fit remain to defy our efforts to control them. Nearly half a century ago, a professor of entomology at Washington State College, A.L. Melander, asked the now purely rhetorical question, "Can insects become resistant to sprays?" If the answer seemed to Melander unclear or slow in coming, that was only because he had asked the question too soon, in 1914 instead of 40 years later. In the pre-DDT era, inorganic chemicals applied on a scale that today would seem extraordinarily modest produced here and there strains of insects that could survive chemical spraying or dusting. Melander himself had run into difficulty with the San Jose scale, for some years satisfactorily controlled by spraying with lime sulfur. Then in the Clarkston area of Washington, the insects became refractory. They were harder to kill than in the orchards of the Wenatchee and Yakima valleys and elsewhere. Suddenly, the scale insects in other parts of the country seemed to have got the same idea. It was not necessary for them to die under the sprayings of lime sulfur, diligently and liberally applied by orchardists. Throughout much of the Midwest, thousands of acres of fine orchards were destroyed by insects now impervious to spraying. Then in California, the time-honored method of placing canvas tents over trees and fumigating them with hydrocyanic acid began to yield disappointing results in certain areas, a problem that led to research at the California Citrus Experiment Station beginning about 1915 and continuing for a quarter of a century. Another insect to learn the profitable ways of resistance was the codling moth, or apple worm, in the 1920s. Although lead arsenate had been used successfully against it for some 40 years. But it was the advent of DDT and all its many relatives that ushered in the true age of resistance. It need have surprised no one with even the simplest knowledge of insects or of the dynamics of animal populations that within a matter of a very few years an ugly and dangerous problem had clearly defined itself. Yet awareness of the fact that insects possess an effective counterweapon to aggressive chemical attack seems to have dawned slowly. Only those concerned with disease-carrying insects seem by now to have been thoroughly aroused to the alarming nature of the situation. The agriculturists still, for the most part, blithely put their faith in the development of new and ever more toxic chemicals, although the present difficulties have been born of just such specious reasoning. If understanding of the phenomenon of insect resistance developed slowly, it was far otherwise with resistance itself. Before 1945, only about a dozen species were known to have developed resistance to any of the pre-DDT insecticides. With the new organic chemicals and new methods for their intensive application, resistance began a meteoric rise that reached the alarming level of 137 species in 1960. No one believes the end is in sight. More than 1,000 technical papers have now been published on the subject. The World Health Organization has enlisted the aid of some 300 scientists in all parts of the world, declaring that resistance is at present the most important single problem facing vector control programs. A distinguished British student of animal populations, Dr. Charles Elton, has said, "We are hearing the early rumblings of what may become an avalanche in strength." Sometimes resistance develops so rapidly that the ink is scarcely dry on a report hailing successful control of a species with some specified chemical when an amended report has to be issued. In South Africa, for example, cattlemen had long been plagued by the blue tick, from which, on one ranch alone, 600 head of cattle had died in 1 year. The tick had for some years been resistant to arsenical dips. Then benzene hexachloride was tried, and for a very short time, all seemed to be well. Reports issued early in the year 1949 declared that the arsenic-resistant ticks could be controlled readily with the new chemical. Later in the same year, a bleak notice of developing resistance had to be published. The situation prompted a writer in the Leather Trades Review to comment in 1950. "News such as this, quietly trickling through scientific circles and appearing in small sections of the overseas press, is enough to make headlines as big as those concerning the new atomic bomb, if only the significance of the matter were properly understood." Although insect resistance is a matter of concern in agriculture and forestry, it is in the field of public health that the most serious apprehensions have been felt. The relation between various insects and many diseases of man is an ancient one. Mosquitoes of the genus Anopheles may inject into the human bloodstream the single-celled organism of malaria. Other mosquitoes transmit yellow fever. Still others carry encephalitis. The housefly, which does not bite, nevertheless by contact, may contaminate human food with the bacillus of dysentery, and in many parts of the world may play an important part in the transmission of eye diseases. The list of diseases and their insect carriers or vectors includes typhus and body lice, plague and rat fleas, African sleeping sickness and tsetse flies, various fevers and ticks, and innumerable others. These are important problems and must be met. No responsible person contends that insect-borne disease should be ignored. The question that has now urgently presented itself is whether it is either wise or responsible to attack the problem by methods that are rapidly making it worse. The world has heard much of the triumphant war against disease through the control of insect vectors of infection, but it has heard little of the other side of the story, the defeats, the short-lived triumphs that now strongly support the alarming view that the insect enemy has been made actually stronger by our efforts. Even worse, we may have destroyed our very means of fighting. A distinguished Canadian entomologist, Dr. A.W.A. Brown, was engaged by the World Health Organization to make a comprehensive survey of the resistance problem. In the resulting monograph, published in 1958, Dr. Brown has this to say. Barely a decade after the introduction of the potent synthetic insecticides in public health programs, the main technical problem is the development of resistance to them by the insects they formerly controlled. In publishing his monograph, the World Health Organization warned that the vigorous offensive now being pursued against arthropod-borne diseases, such as malaria, typhus fever, and plague, risks a serious setback unless this new problem can be rapidly mastered. What is the measure of this setback? The list of resistant species now includes practically all of the insect groups of medical importance. Apparently, the black flies, sand flies, and tsetse flies have not yet become resistant to chemicals. On the other hand, resistance among house flies and body lice has now developed on a global scale. Malaria programs are threatened by resistance among mosquitoes. The oriental rat flea, the principal vector of plague, has recently demonstrated resistance to DDT, a most serious development. Countries reporting resistance among a large number of other species represent every continent and most of the island groups. Probably the first medical use of modern insecticides occurred in Italy in 1943, when the Allied military government launched a successful attack on typhus by dusting enormous numbers of people with DDT. This was followed 2 years later by extensive application of residual sprays for the control of malaria mosquitoes. Only a year later, the first signs of trouble appeared. Both houseflies and mosquitoes of the genus Culex began to show resistance to the sprays. In 1948, a new chemical, chlordane, was tried as a supplement to DDT. This time, good control was obtained for 2 years. But by August of 1950, chlordane-resistant flies appeared. And by the end of that year, all the houseflies, as well as the Culex mosquitoes, seemed to be resistant to chlordane. As rapidly as new chemicals were brought into use, resistance developed. By the end of 1951, DDT, methoxychlor, chlordane, heptachlor, and benzene hexachloride had joined the list of chemicals no longer effective. The flies, meanwhile, had become fantastically abundant. The same cycle of events was being repeated in Sardinia during the late 1940s. In Denmark, products containing DDT were first used in 1944. By 1947, fly control had failed in many places. In some areas of Egypt, flies had already become resistant to DDT by 1948. BHC was substituted, but was effective for less than a year. One Egyptian village in particular symbolizes the problem. Insecticides gave good control of flies in 1950, and during the same year, the infant mortality rate was reduced by nearly 50%. The next year, nevertheless, flies were resistant to DDT and chlordane. The fly population returned to its former level, so did infant mortality. In the United States, DDT resistance among flies had become widespread in the Tennessee Valley by 1948. Other areas followed. Attempts to restore control with dieldrin met with little success, for in some places the flies developed strong resistance to this chemical within only 2 months. After running through all the available chlorinated hydrocarbons, control agencies turned to the organic phosphates. But here again, the story of resistance was repeated. The present conclusion of experts is that housefly control has escaped insecticidal techniques and once more must be based on general sanitation.
This ends Disc 8.